Hi everyone, I'm Chris Saldana and this is the National Education Policy Center's Talks Education Podcast. On this month's podcast, we discuss the process and practice of state takeovers of K-12 public school districts. Our first guest this month is Dr. Beth Schuler. Dr. Schuler is a professor of education and public policy at the University of Virginia. She studies education policy, politics, and inequality with a focus on efforts to improve low-performing K-12 schools and districts. She uses both quantitative and qualitative methods to learn which policies are most effective at improving educational organizations and what makes these policies more or less politically viable. Dr. Schuler, along with her co-authors Josh Blyberg and Melissa Arnold-Lyon, is the co-author of two research studies that quantitatively examine the impact of takeovers on student academic outcomes and school district finances. So how do states justify state takeovers, and what are the goals of the practice?
So I think there are typically sort of two primary reasons that states tend to give when they enact takeovers. One is sort of financial. So maybe there's, you know, a heavy debt load or kind of perceived or real kind of financial mismanagement in the district. So those are the financial. And then the other big category is sort of low academic performance in terms of student performance. Now, those two things are often correlated. And so it's I think, a little tricky to really oftentimes identify a single reason or kind of the necessarily the true reason, but I think those are kind of the two primary you know, sort of rationales for why this happens.
So you mentioned that there haven't been that many. Is there enough information out there for us to be able to know or get a sense for what the impact of takeovers are on student outcomes or on district operations or district decision-making?
Yeah, so I think, you know, there's a growing, not huge, but growing kind of body of literature that I think helps to speak to those questions for sure. So there's historically been kind of a series of kind of case studies of individual takeovers. You know, the tricky thing there is that like a lot can vary in, you know, from case to case, both in terms of the contexts that are under takeover, and then also the sort of policies that leaders pursue once they enact takeover. But so, you know, one thing that that I've tried to do with one of my co-authors, Josh Blyberg, who's now at University of Pittsburgh. So we have a paper where we tracked all the takeovers that have occurred since the late 1980s through 2016. This was written, you know, a few years ago. And then for a subset of those takeovers, so the ones from, I think, 2011 to 2016, we could sort of estimate the impact of takeover on student academic achievement outcomes, because that was the window for which we had achievement data that allows for kind of cross-state comparisons. And so what we found there was sort of on average, kind of no evidence that takeover seemed to kind of improve academic achievement outcomes. And we're specifically looking at kind of math and English language arts test scores. Some suggestive evidence that it can be kind of disruptive, can be harmful to especially reading achievement for whatever reason in the early years of reform, but kind of no impact on average if you look, you know, across all these takeovers within that window.
So what have you found about the heterogeneity or variation across different kinds of districts?
We found that there's a lot of it, first and foremost. So, you know, as I mentioned, like on average, kind of null to small negative impacts. But there are, you know, some positive cases. There's some negative cases, some cases where this didn't seem to move the needle at all. And then some kind of positive proof points where takeover did seem to actually improve academic achievement. And one of the districts that's in our sample is a district that I've spent some time myself kind of studying as a particular case, the Lawrence Public School System in Massachusetts. So that was a district that kind of was low performing for many years and underwent takeover in 2012. And they made some pretty dramatic changes there. And, you know, there were, and so we kind of evaluated those efforts and found pretty notable improvements, at least in the early years of the reform in math achievement. And, you know, it's an interesting case because there are also some signs that things didn't just go well in terms of the student outcomes, but also the politics were a little bit, you know, not that there wasn't pushback, but they seemed to go, things seemed to go a little more smoothly there than your kind of stereotypical case of sort of state takeover and district-wide turnaround. So that's an interesting case. It's just an example of a positive proof point, but more kind of systematically, when we've looked at the variation, you know, across the country, what we found is, for one thing, the effects of takeover on academic achievement are least positive in relatively higher performing contexts. So, you know, all of these districts tend to be lower performing that are targeted for takeover. But then, you know, within that group, there are some that are the very, very lowest performing, you know, in the country, and some that are more, you know, not super well high performing, but not the very, very lowest. And so what we find is that takeovers are least effective in the relatively higher performing context. So I think, you know, states want to be really careful about enacting this unless it's in the some of the very, very lowest performing districts in the country. So that's one thing. And then we also find some interesting variation depending on kind of the racial or ethnic makeup of the school districts. So we find that takeovers historically have been less effective in majority Black districts, so districts that are serving high concentrations of Black students. And, you know, I think that's especially important because we also find that those districts are more likely to be taken over, more likely to be kind of targeted for takeover, even after you kind of control for academic performance. So if you compare kind of two districts that are both similarly low performing, but one's, you know, and obviously I'm simplifying here, but one's a majority white district, one's a majority Black district, the majority black district is more likely to be taken over. So these takeovers seem particularly risky in these majority Black communities. Now, on the flip side, we find the effects have been, on average, more positive in majority Hispanic communities. One possible reason that for that kind of heterogeneity that I think is at least consistent with the evidence we have in terms of like why is this happening differently for different kinds of communities, I think has to do with how takeover seems to impact the local politics and particularly kind of the descriptive representation of local officials. So the extent to which local elected officials demographically reflect the communities that they're serving and representing. And I know you're also speaking with political scientist Domingo Morel. In his work, he finds that, or my read of his work is that when takeover occurs in majority Black communities, it tends to decrease descriptive representation. So decrease the number of Black local elected officials. But the opposite is true when it occurs in majority Latino communities. So it actually seems to in some way increase or pave the way for greater descriptive representation. And that's kind of consistent with the effects we're finding on student outcomes, right? Greater positive effects for students in majority Latino districts, greater negative effects when takeover occurs in majority Black communities.
When you think about some of the lessons that you've learned from this research, you mentioned earlier that takeover isn't a very popular policy, both for stakeholders, and it isn't one that's necessarily overly used by state policymakers either. It's kind of rare. As you see occurrences of state takeovers now, and obviously the prominent one now is Houston, what recommendations would you give to policymakers as they make these considerations and decisions about whether to take over districts?
Yeah, so, you know, I think having embarked on this work, looking at sort of the average effects of takeovers nationwide, I was in some ways poised to, you know, I didn't know what I would find, but I had come to that work having studied this kind of positive proof point of, you know, the Lawrence public school system in Massachusetts. So I thought it was not impossible I could find something positive, but looking sort of across the country, found that Lawrence was kind of an outlier, right? That on average, takeover didn't seem to lead to improvements. And so it doesn't seem like state takeover is a sort of silver bullet. It's not impossible that it can lead to improvements, but it doesn't seem like it's kind of like, you know, the answer in all places. And, you know, as you mentioned, this can be really politically contentious. And I have some public opinion work with Marty West actually using kind of nationally representative data that suggests these takeovers can be politically quite kind of unpopular, specifically among folks within the districts kind of most likely to be targeted for takeover, and also among teachers. So, you know, other constituents that are likely to be, or stakeholder groups that are likely to be more directly affected. And so we sort of make the argument that, you know, it seems particularly contentious among those who are kind of most likely to lose political power, economic power as a result of these reforms. So I think when I'm thinking about, you know, recommendations for states, I think it's important to think about the kind of public reception of reforms and, you know, because you got to kind of rely on teachers to implement your reforms and rely on communities to sort of support those reforms if you want them to kind of stick and sustain themselves over time. And so I think it's important to think about kind of the public's views of these issues. And then the other thing I would say is that luckily, I think there are some other avenues to trying to generate improvements in low performing schools and districts, you know, in the U.S. So I've also worked on a kind of meta-analysis where we looked at all of the kind of impact evaluations of efforts to try to improve schools or districts that have been labeled as low performing, regardless of whether it occurred in the context of state takeover or not. And, you know, we find not huge average impacts, but positive impacts on average. And And a lot of those gains are concentrated in the reforms that seem to focus on things like extended learning time and efforts to try to improve human capital and kind of the teaching force in these systems. And so I think there are some possible alternatives that leaders could consider, you know, without enacting takeover when they're thinking about trying to, you know, deliver for students in these systems.
Our second guest this month is Dr. Domingo Morel. Dr. Morel is a professor at New York University's Robert F. Wagner School of Public Service and holds a joint appointment in NYU's Wilf Family Department of Politics. His research focuses on racial and ethnic politics, urban politics, education politics, and public policy. He is also the author of Takeover, Race, Education, and American Democracy. So for listeners who aren't familiar with the formation of state takeover policies, what do we know about the socio-political context that have motivated the design and implementation of district takeover policies?
So I think in order to understand the context, I think there are two important things to consider. One is the educational context, and then one more broader political context, right? And so in terms of education during this time, you know, takeovers start to emerge in the late 1980s, early 1990s. And so this is at the period of, you know, in terms of education, this accountability movement, where we're using really test scores and all these different outcomes measures to, you know, kind of assess how schools are doing and then implementing different types of interventions to address this. So it's happening, you know, during this moment of accountability, a movement of accountability. And then more broader on the political context side, right? You know, since this is happening in the 1980s, there are some things that are happening by this time. You know, Black political empowerment in cities had, you know, about a decade, right? Because it's by the 1970s where we really start to see cities across the country really increase their Black majority cities increase their political power. Same thing during this time, we see how states are becoming more active in local context and, you know, particularly education. And, you know, I argue in my work that this has a direct result of directly related to the growth of Black political empowerment in cities and what that caused. So I think when we think about the context of takeovers emerging, we have the education part and the more broader political part that we need to take into account.
So beyond the policy concerns of student outcomes and district operations, which is often the focus of traditional policy scholars, when a state takes over, what happens to kids, what happens to how district leaders make decisions, and obviously that's important, but you being a political scientist have focused on some of the side effects of takeovers. So what are some of the other implications of state takeovers of school districts?
Yeah, that's a great question. And, you know, as you mentioned, as a political scientist, I'm interested in these political questions. And when I first started studying state takeovers, that's the literature was mostly focused, as you mentioned, on what are the outcomes of takeovers. And of course, they're important. But, you know, as those of us who study education, not just political scientists, but education more broadly, we know that education is an important part of like our broader, you know, political project in this country, right? And so when I started to study these state takeovers from a political perspective, there are certain things that emerge. Number one is that they're overwhelmingly happening in communities of color, right? And particularly Black communities. And so while the justification for state takeovers have, you know, often been that somehow the schools are struggling, whether it's academically or financially, we have over 10,000 school districts in this country. And if it was just that school districts are struggling, we'll see a lot more takeovers. And not just of majority Black school districts or majority Latinx school districts, right? And that's not the case, right? So that's number one. Number two is that they're not only happening in majority communities of color, specifically majority Black communities, but that they're being led by Black political leadership. So at the school board level, city council level, and mayoral level, right? We see that happening as well. And when a state takeover actually happens, there are school boards are treated in one of three ways. Either one, the elected school board, you know, most school districts across the country have an elected school board. And in some cases, the elected school board following the takeover stays in place. A second option is that the state removes the locally elected school board and replaces it with an appointed school board. And then the third is that they remove the locally elected school board and don't replace it at all. And so what my research shows is that while the majority of takeovers are not happening in majority white communities. There have been several white communities that have experienced takeovers, but they get to keep the elected school board in place in majority of cases. However, for majority Black communities, in majority of cases, they lose the elected school board. Sometimes they get replaced by an appointed school board, and sometimes they don't get replaced at all. So there's like no school board at all, right? And so that's a political dynamics of it as well. And then there are two more points that I think are important to understand. One is, so, you know, obviously racial component is important to this. And then the other is partisanship, right? So in order for a state to take over a school district, there has to be a law in the books that allow them to do that. And most of these state takeover laws were pushed by Republican governors. Right. And then when actual takeovers are happening, they're mostly happening with Republican support at the gubernatorial and state legislative level. And they're, of course, being taken over. The cities that are being taken over are these majority communities of color, which are predominantly Democratic cities. So the partisan dynamic is important to understand here, too. And then finally, there's a financial component. Right. So my research shows that, you know, in the 1970s and 1980s, communities, low resource communities, were fighting for more resources for their school districts, right? And when they at the state level, and when they actually won court cases to get more resources for their schools, that increased the likelihood that a state will pass a takeover law, right? So the argument has often been that communities don't care about their schools, and, you know, that's the reason why takeovers need to happen. But my research shows it's something different, that it's precisely at the time when communities win lawsuits to get more resources for the schools because they care about their schools, that then takeovers start to happen, right? So these are kind of the political implications and consequences of state takeover.
What does your research suggest about the use of state takeover policies? You mentioned that they're on the books. There's been some other research that shows that most, if not all, states now have some form of accountability or state takeover policy. What does your research suggest about using these kinds of policies for educational change and improvement?
Yeah, I mean, so I think that the research is pretty clear by this point. We have over 30 years of evidence to show, to learn about takeovers as an intervention and the consequences. And the results are not what they're promised, right? So we just don't have good evidence across, you know, 100 plus school districts over this 30-year period that takeovers lead to these promised outcomes of better test scores, better graduation rates, and these kinds of measures. We just don't. There are some school districts here and there where we see some improvement at first, and then in many cases, it just levels off and sometimes gets worse. But overwhelmingly, we don't find positive results. But what we do find are the negative political economic consequences for these communities, right? So, you know, losing your school board, losing the ability to have a say in how, you know, schools are governed for your children, how, you know, schools are being used, whether they're being closed or not, who are the teachers that are being hired or fired, right? Who's the superintendent? How do you use, you know, public spaces? These schools are public spaces. How do you use them for the community? So losing the ability to have this say, in addition to the economic consequences of this, right? So school budgets represent the largest part of local budgets across cities in this country. And when you lose the ability to determine how that is, how you're going to make these expenditures, that means a lot to a community, right? And so the economic power there is negatively affected as well. So politically, economically, is devastating for communities, while we don't see any real significant progress made as a result of a takeover in terms of educational outcome.
Our final guest this month is Dr. David DeMatthews. Dr. DeMatthews is a professor in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy at the University of Texas at Austin. Dr. Matthews' research focuses on equitable and inclusive school improvement with an emphasis on leadership and policy. More specifically, he aims to understand how districts and schools create equitable and inclusive schools at the intersections of race, social class, language, and other markers of identity. So why did the state of Texas take over Houston ISD?
So that's a good question, and it's a little bit complicated. So the state initially began action to take over Houston ISD several years ago, and for a few reasons. First, because there was some pretty serious ethical and legal concerns around the board and the chief operating officer and some vendors. And so there was some really problematic issues in that regard. So there were these ethical and legal issues. The state had a conservator appointed in Houston ISD actually at that same time, also overseeing Kashmir High School for having issues with academic achievement and performance over multiple years. And now Wheatley High School, another high school in Houston, was persistently receiving the letter F in the state accountability system. So that was another reason. And for those reasons, the state moved to take over the school district. There was a lawsuit that ensued. And in March 2023, a Texas court decided that the state had the authority and right to take over the school district. So Commissioner Morath moved relatively quickly and announced that he would be removing the school board, removing the superintendent, appointing a board of managers, and naming a new superintendent. The reason why I say why is the state of Texas taking over Houston ISD is more complicated is because, so that's the company line. So EA, Commissioner Morath has stated those claims, and more recently, systemic issues with special education in the state, I mean, in Houston ISD, particularly around timely evaluations for potentially eligible students with disabilities. But there's a lot more behind the scenes that I think raises some pretty serious questions. First of all, this commissioner has exercised the state takeover power that he has that's codified in Texas law more than any of his predecessors. But most of the times where he has, or all of the times that he's taken over a school district, they've been relatively small, sometimes only a few thousand students. And often they've only been around financial mismanagement. So first of all, the state's just not, has not been in the game of taking over extremely large school districts like Houston ISD. It has almost 200,000 students, 250 or so campuses. Second, a lot has changed between the time where he initially moved in 2019 to take over the school district in 2023. So during that time, the school board turned over. All the individuals that were engaged in that unethical and illegal activity are removed and long gone. There's a new superintendent, and Wheatley High School, kind of the epicenter of the commissioner's case, is rated now a C in the commissioner's own standards-based accountability system. And Houston ISD itself is a B-rated district. And that seems like it's pretty striking. Why would you take over that district? But on top of that, kind of to make matters even worse, there are dozens of Texas school districts that have been rated D or F, and the commissioner didn't move to take them over. And then on top of that, I think what is probably one of the biggest scandals in Texas, IDEA Public Charter School has engaged in serious mismanagement of funds. The state has investigated them several times. They didn't find anything, but ultimately IDEA investigated itself and found systemic noncompliance. Found that its leaders were misusing funds in a variety of ways. The commissioner has power to take over that board, reconstitute that board, just like he did in Houston and other places, and he's ignored it. And so there has been widespread fraud in a lot of charters, widespread unethical practices in a lot of charters. The commissioner has turned a complete blind eye to that, but he's focused on Houston ISD for some reason. And so it's really hard to make sense of why the state of Texas took over Houston ISD when you're gonna consider the entire landscape of Texas right now.
You made a distinction between the company line and what's actually happening on the ground. What changes has the state made, given that they made these justifications? And are any of these changes concerning to you?
I think the first concerning move was when the takeover was announced by the commissioner. There were public meetings, and the commissioner didn't show up to any of them. The community, particularly Black and Latino community, was very upset. These are their schools that are kind of at the epicenter of this controversy, and the commissioner didn't show up himself. Something for listeners that's also important to kind of know about Texas right now is the governor and the lieutenant governor have been really vocal attacking public schools and promoting school vouchers. Basically every day on their social media accounts, on TV, on radio, in their campaigns, there's this kind of outright attack on teachers. And also there has been voter suppression in Texas, and there's a lot of members of the Houston ISD community that feels like this is just another example of voter suppression in Texas in Black and Brown communities. The appointment of Mike Miles, though, also was an immediate concerning point for me. So Mike Miles is a Broad Fellow. So he didn't come up through the ranks as an educator, principal, superintendent. He was a U.S. Army Ranger. He started a small charter network. And he had led a small district in northern Colorado before being appointed by Dallas ISD as superintendent. And the commissioner of TA today was on that board at that time. And while in Dallas ISD, Miles was an extremely controversial, disruptive, and really ineffective superintendent for a variety of reasons. There were issues with bringing in people from his other district and doubling their salaries. There were issues with teacher turnover. Teacher turnover spiked almost immediately. And one thing that the media and policy experts haven't really talked about Miles's time in Dallas. So test scores didn't go up, all those things. But, you know, there's always this dialogue around, you know, did test scores go up? And, you know, how are you assessing that? But one thing that always gets left out is that Dallas ISD, during Miles' tenure for special ed, was failing. And so when TA Commissioner Morath appointed Miles, who resigned from Dallas after all this controversy and failure, he's appointing somebody who doesn't have a track record of success. And then some of his policies, it seems very apparent that Miles just had not learned from that experience. And so being a superintendent is a really hard job, right? And being the superintendent of a school district like Dallas, I think it's really easy for professors to be critical of a superintendent. It's a really hard job. And so I can appreciate a new superintendent making a mistake. But what I can't appreciate is a superintendent making a mistake and then making it again and then making it again and then making it again. And so one would expect that Miles would have learned that you cannot improve a school district with controversy and with adversarial approaches and where the community is not buying into your approach. But almost immediately, some of the measures that he's taken in Houston ISD are shocking and honestly senseless. They're not empirically based. They seem ideologically driven and just mean-spirited. And so I'll give a couple examples of those. The first things first, in the 28 schools in Houston where the commissioner and the state wanted to focus its attention due to those schools not performing well on standardized tests, Mike Miles made all those teachers reapply for their jobs. Now, surely people have different beliefs about, you know, expectations and accountability and setting the bar high, but there is a massive teacher shortage in the United States. 60% of the teachers in Texas are alternatively certified. Most of them are from very low for-profit companies. They have high rates of turnover as it is, and they disproportionately work in struggling schools. So struggling schools are really, they're challenged to even hire teachers and fill vacancies. So creating a policy right off the bat where you're going to force everyone to reapply for their job, that's going to put those schools potentially in a really challenging place. Now is not the time to disrupt the teacher workforce. The pandemic has done that. The fact that the state of Texas hasn't used any of its $34 billion budget surplus to increase teacher salaries, despite a significant cost of living increase in Texas, I think that was a very problematic policy. But then you take a policy that maybe a lot of people don't agree with, but still think, okay, he's trying to really set the tone here. But then he, in those same 28 schools, moves to eliminate those schools' librarians and close their libraries during the academic school day. And, you know, this really put the community in an uproar. It's become national news. It's been in the Washington Post and the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. And questioning this idea of firing librarians in schools where there's an issue with reading achievement and turning those libraries into discipline centers in Black and Brown communities, in low-income communities where kids may not have access to books and information technology and that caring, safe space. So that has been an extremely problematic policy that I think is really indefensible. They've put out responses, but I think it's embarrassing that he would make that move. I think it's embarrassing to the commissioner that somebody that he appointed would engage in a policy that would just be so senseless. So it's been one thing after another. And I think any superintendent with just a little bit of experience and common sense would know coming into this type of school district at this moment, even if I subscribe to some of these more controversial policies, that I'm going to have to slow walk this. I'm going to have to build trust just given the context. And that has been completely kind of thrown out the window. And so basically everything we've seen from Miles has been concerning.
If I'm a parent in Houston ISD, or if I'm a parent in a district that a state is considering taking over, what kinds of recommendations would you have for stakeholders? How to engage with state policymakers, how to engage with superintendents. It seems like the situation is pretty dire. There isn't much room that's being given to community members, but what opportunities do stakeholders have?
That's a good question. I think if you're a white affluent family living in Texas, you probably have nothing to worry about. And, you know, you don't have to listen anymore if you're just kind of concerned about your child. But I think for the majority of parents in Texas and the majority of students, it really seems like the governor's office, the commissioner are not really interested in what the community's needs are, what the public schools need to be successful, that basic infrastructure is just not there. And so I think, you know, parents, particularly low income parents, black and brown parents, I think they're really in a very difficult spot in Texas. And I'll tell you another group that kind of gets left off, rural schools. And so right now, about half the population of rural students in Texas are students of color. But, you know, there's this dispersion of district type rural districts in Texas, some all white, some very diverse, some majority Latino. But those districts are extremely underserved. They have very high rates of principal turnover, teacher shortages, a variety of issues, and really no one is there for them at all. And so it's really discouraging right now for families. I guess the best thing that I could say to parents is to organize, to try to raise awareness about some of the policies that the state is enacting. And to vote in every single election, whether it's a school board election or for the legislature, for the governor and lieutenant governor, because there is very clearly in Texas an attack by the governor and by the commissioner on their own public schools.
Thank you, Dr. Schuler, Dr. Morrell, and Dr. DeMatthews for being on this month's podcast. As always, we hope you're safe and healthy. And remember that for the latest analysis, you should subscribe to NEPC's newsletter and publication announcements at nepc.colorado.edu.